Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, Comfort Horror. We asked more than 500,000 horror fans online what their go-to comfort horror movie or show was, and we're here with their answers and ours. I find this topic really intriguing for a couple of reasons. One, because it's oxymoronic, right? Like, comfort horror on its face seems like something that almost shouldn't exist. The horror genre is there to unsettle you, to take you on a scary ride, to make you hide your eyes, to make your breath tremble and your heart shake. That is not something we usually associate with comfort. But when I asked this question on our pages to our community, we got thousands of answers, and there are so many different answers in the voting. The voting was crazy this time. I had to really try to figure out what was going on and where the patterns were, which always excites me that it's not easy. This also isn't particularly easy for me because I'm a serious person to a fault, probably. And comfort horror isn't my genre of choice or subgenre of choice necessarily. But after going through all your answers, I realized I'm doing comfort horror my own way. It just wasn't the way I thought of it originally. So I'm excited to really challenge myself to figure out what my comfort horror niche pockets are, so to speak. So I'm going to go through a couple what I think are really good examples of comfort horror movies for reasons. What are the particular reasons horror fans find comfort in these kind of movies? What are the categories that might pertain here? And then we'll get to the voting, where the winner wasn't necessarily a surprise, but the runners-up were kind of mind-blowing. Now, one of the obvious categories that emerged in the comfort horror topic space was familiarity, right? A lot of people were naming movies and then saying that the reason that that was comfort horror to them was they'd seen them dozens or hundreds of times. So it was just a movie they loved. In most cases, it's a movie that a lot of horror fans loved. So there's sort of a built-in community aspect to it. And it's, in almost every case, movies that are very, very rewatchable for whatever reason. I would say about half of the answers in the voting were movies that were located in franchises. And that makes sense, right? Because when you turn to something for comfort horror in terms of familiarity, if something's in a franchise, you have multiple reasons to rewatch it. You're going to rewatch it because you love it. You're also going to rewatch it if you just binge an entire franchise entries. Those movies tend to penetrate more into pop culture, so you'll see references about them on The Simpsons or whatnot. They'll end up in Treehouse of Horror or something. They'll be at cons. So this all makes sense. One of the big comfort horror answers, I'll give a little spoiler to the voting now, was Scream. And it was the original Scream. Literally nobody picked any other Scream entry as a comfort horror. And there were other franchises where there were movies later down the franchise entry train that were getting votes, but not the Scream franchise. It was always the first one. Now, in terms of familiarity, one of my comfort horror movies is Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, which is a Christopher Lee Hammer Dracula film. This isn't just a movie that I've seen a bunch of times and that I find really rewatchable, but it's also an entry in a franchise of sorts, but it sort of rhymes with the other Christopher Lee Dracula movies, at least until they got crazy later and turned into Disco Dracula. But Dracula and his rules and the atmosphere that almost always attends his appearances in films, the castle and the fog and the mist and the bats, these things all have become familiar been coded through literally hundreds of movies at this point. And Hammer itself had its own particular way of presenting Dracula, which also becomes very familiar. They also really stripped down the concept, much like the James Whale's Frankenstein eschews the articulate creature of Mary Shelley's novel. Frankenstein's not walking around giving dissertations on the romantic zeitgeist, right? Like, he's just roaming the countryside, causing trouble almost against his own will, but grunting and groaning and glowering. In Christopher Lee's Dracula, there isn't a lot of talking going on. So this is basically creature versus human versus religion kind of in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. And I think one of the secret things that lies under some comfort horror, at least for me, is the idea of a vacation, right? Like, the Hammer Dracula film, or Dracula Has Risen from the Grave particularly, has this feel of escaping to another moment in time and another land, a different place than where I live. Like, I don't live in England. This is part of why, like, The Strangers isn't a comfort horror for me, because I've, like, hung out in a kitchen talking to my girlfriend, or been in a kitchen seeing, like, shadows or hearing sounds. And if it turned out to be incredibly relentless home invaders that I have no chance against, that's just, like, something bad, that a twist on something I lived in my life that went bad, which doesn't feel particularly comforting to me. But Hammer Draculas are their own world, and for the time that you spend watching the movie, you're there. Another category of what makes horror movies comforting sometimes that came through in the voting was fun. Now, there were some straight-up horror comedies like Shaun of the Dead that were getting a bunch of votes for comfort horror, but as anyone who's listened to this podcast for any amount of time is going to know, I've struggled to come to love the horror comedy genre. So I don't have any horror comedies on my comfort horror list that I know of. Maybe one will come while we're talking. Even one is that I love, like Tucker and Dale versus Evil, I wouldn't consider a comfort horror movie to me. And maybe we'll get to the definition of that later, because it is fun to watch and I have seen it several times, but for some reason I wouldn't define it that way for myself. But Final Destination 3 is a surprising comfort horror for me. I did not expect it to be a movie that I rewatched as much as I have. I didn't expect it to even be one of my favorites in the Final Destination franchise, because I don't think it's as well made necessarily as 1, 2, and maybe even 5, which has the benefit of having that spectacular wraparound effect that almost no horror franchise. I know Final Destination has a lot of haters and gets a lot of shit, but I mean, the elegant way they spun that franchise back right around onto itself is something that a lot of franchises that horror fans like a lot more than Final Destination have never pulled off in their final entry. But there's something different about FD3 to me. And one is, I think the performance from Mary Elizabeth Winstead is fantastic. And I think it's more death obsessed. I know that's going to sound weird given the premise of these movies. It's more death obsessed than the other ones. It dwells longer in the cemeteries and with the grieving. For some reason, it just feels a little gloomier than the other entries to me. But this is where the magic comes in. It's also based on a roller coaster disaster. So there's a fun, we're taking you on a ride element to this. Now, this fascinates me because I don't even remember Final Destination 4. I think that's the race car one. I probably only watched it like a half time. I'm not even sure I finished it. But I really liked the other entries in Final Destination. And when you think of what's causing the death scenarios, the mass death scenarios in those, a plane crash, the infamous log truck on the highway, the bridge collapse. These are all everyday things. Every day you might cross a bridge on the way to work or off to see a family member or something. Every day you might find yourself on a freeway behind a truck. Oftentimes you'll find yourself getting on a plane. These are all kind of have-to-do things or things that you can't avoid. A roller coaster is built to scare you, and it's something that you only go on voluntarily. And I feel like, in a weird way, the choice of disaster in Final Destination 3 bleeds through into the vibes of the rest of the film, which are, we're going to give you some of the most spectacular kills in the franchise. All I got to do is say Roller Coaster of Love, and you'll know what I'm talking about. But because the movie is grounded on something that is built to safely scare you and then get you off the ride, and then it subverts that by saying, you know what, sometimes you take scary rides and they get you. It's like fun with a bite. And that's what makes this movie to me feel fun but gloomy. It's like a Cure song. This is the fascination street of horror films. But now I want to talk about a movie I love, love. A movie I watch at least once a year, if not more. And a movie that's a comfort horror movie for me in a very special way. In a fairer world, this movie would be as well known as Frankenstein or Carnival of Souls, which it has some things in common with, which also Carnival of Souls is a big comfort horror movie of mine, but I want to talk about this other one in particular. And I'm talking about 1945's Isle of the Dead. Isle was the second of three movies that Boris Karloff made for Val Lewton, who might be my favorite historical horror figure of all time, considering Cat People is my favorite horror movie ever. This film was directed by Mark Robson, who was nominated twice for Best Picture, Best Director Academy Awards. Now, this movie has 1,000 virtues, and I'm a little sad to be talking about it on this episode, considering I've been toying with the idea of an Can Old Horror Movies Still Scare You episode, and if in that episode, this movie certainly would have featured, but I can't help but talk about it here because it's probably in my top three of comfort horror movies personally. So let's take the comfort angle on this movie for a second. So all of us, I'm sure, have a couple subgenres that are more comfort than the other ones, right? Like, I'm sure a lot of you listening out there, 80s slashers might be a comfort genre for you. Creature features might be. For me, I grew up on classic horror, like black and white horror, the universal ones. This is why I mentioned Carnival of Souls. But they were my gateway into horror. And if you'd asked a, 18-year-old me to name a comfort horror movie, I'm sure he would have said Bride of Frankenstein. So why do I not say that anymore? Well, one, I've seen it too often, but that doesn't count because I've seen Isle of the Dead, I don't know, like 50 times. So that can't quite be it. It's part of the fact is that it's like some of those classic horror movies, but also not like. There's something off about it. It's like Vincent D'Onofrio's character in Men in Black after he becomes possessed by the alien, after he's wearing the Edgar suit. Like, he still looks like Edgar, but, and some of the people who knew Edgar are trying to interact with him like he's still him, but it's not cool, not him anymore. Bride of Frankenstein feels like a universal monster movie to me. They all have a very similar feel. The Mummy, Dracula, Frankenstein. Maybe it's just because I watched them all in a block several times, but they feel a lot like each other. They feel like very closely related siblings. Isle of the Dead feels like a classic horror movie, but also not, because it's really its own thing unto itself. This movie was inspired by a painting, which that has to be a pretty rare inspiration for movies, where like you see a painting and you're like, I want to make a feature film that is inspired by this. The painting is by an artist named Arnold Bachland. It's called Isle of the Dead. There were several different versions of it, but all of them show a rowboat coming into like a spooky looking island in the middle of dark water. It's a really ominous and grand image. The famous novelist Vladimir Nabokov wrote in his novel Despair that all pre-World War II homes in Berlin had this painting on their walls. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of a mind-blowing thing to consider. Like, every house in a major metropolitan area had a painting, and this is a really ominous, very grim painting. So I'm sure that says something about pre-World War II Berlin. But also, I really like when something, like, let's say the painting is sort of the horror genre, right? It certainly wouldn't be out of place in an exhibition of horror-themed paintings. It's so creepy looking and subtle. And when you think about the fact that it penetrated culture to that extent, it kind of reminds me of like what happened to America briefly when Tim Burton's original Batman released in 1989. All of a sudden, for, you know, 4 weeks or longer, it was a huge hit. The entire country was goth. Everybody was goth. Well, this painting seems to have had a similar hold in the culture of a major country. And in a more sinister note, the painting was so loved by Adolf Hitler that he bought one of the original versions of that the artist had made for himself, and he hung it in the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. The synopsis of the plot for Isle is, on a Greek island during the 1912 war, several people are trapped by quarantine for the plague. If that isn't enough worry, one of the people, a superstitious old peasant, suspects a young woman of being a vampiric demon. I'm telling you, if I'm having a really bad week or something's got me just spun up, I can throw this movie on a dark night. And like I said, I don't want to overhype this for the people who are like, oh, no movie ever scares me or whatever. But, you know, if you use your imagination, and you've heard me say this on this podcast a bunch of times now at this point, you know, I like to take a movie out on a portable, you know, like an iPad or something, you know, into a misty night all alone, like, you know, in a park somewhere, and watch it and see if I give it the benefit of a really good atmosphere around it or circumstance, can the movie get to me? Is it easy to walk home at 2:30 in the morning after watching, you know, X film? And a lot of movies, when you give them a chance, can have a little bit of a opportunity to creep under your skin in a way where if you just watch it while you're like, you know, washing the dishes or, you know, like doing vacuuming the room and looking at it on your big screen TV in the middle of the day, those movies have no chance. But this movie, my God, you watch this in the right atmosphere. As a matter of fact, fuck it. If I watch this in the day while I'm vacuuming the room, this movie can still get to me. But once I fire this thing up and that RKO Pictures logo hits the screen and the beautiful black and white starts to unfurl and that gorgeous string music kicks in at the very beginning of the film as the titles roll, I am comforted. And there's a freshness to it, which was my point with the Universal movies and how everything starts to lump together and feel sort of the same. There's not a lot else like Isle of the Dead. It's got fog and mist, but it doesn't look like the fog and mist of other movies. It's got shadows, but they don't look like the shadows in most other horror films. It's got a Boris Karloff performance, but he doesn't look the way he looks in almost all his other films. He's not even the monster here, sort of. He's not even the villain here, sort of. Like I said, everything's like a tick to the left or a tick to the right off of what classical horror movies usually feel like. Another thing that just inevitably brings comfort to me as a horror fan is when I'm swimming in excellence. This movie is just so well done. You feel like you're in such good hands. The entire character of Boris Karloff, he's playing a Greek general named Pheridas in this movie, who's nicknamed the Watchdog, that will become important later. But everything, almost everything important about this character is conveyed to you in the very first scene, almost in the first few shots. When we see him, we see a pair of hands in a bowl ferociously washing themselves, hand washing. And then the camera pans up and we see General Faridi's face. And he is being confronted by a traitor amidst his ranks, or a failure, a soldier who has failed amidst his ranks, who's surrounded by other soldiers. And he looks very confident, almost calmly angry and a little disappointed, but he looks supremely in charge. Like, I know what I'm doing. Everything I'm doing is right. I'm justified in the things that I do. But meanwhile, he's washing his hands like a motherfucker. And anyone who's ever seen a Shakespeare play will know that ferociously scrubbing your hands over and over again is a sign of trying to wash away some kind of guilt. So his body language conveys a little bit of guilt and insecurity. His face exudes nothing but supreme confidence and command. And the soldiers that were shown in this really cool shot at the opening are, he's in a tent, an army tent on the field, on the battlefield. And all we see is their shadows. We hear their voices talking to him, but we're only seeing these shadows. He's being thronged by shadows. And it really does feel like this is a general of a ghost army, that they're stalked by something. And also that he's a little bit impersonal about how he treats their lives, which is going to come across immediately in this scene when he orders this guy who failed to go kill himself, to like basically do seppuku. And it's going to turn out that the person who failed him that he gave this order to was not just one of his second in commands, but a friend. But he doesn't flinch from the duty. He needs to clean up the incompetence. And you'll see if you ever watch this movie or have seen it, and if you haven't seen it, my God. if you love classic horror movies, if you can't stand black and white, then move along. But he's so tall. He's just looming over these soldiers like a giant. Their lives just seem less consequential because of the visuals that this scene is executed in, even though the movie is really humanistic and cares about its people. It's showing us that the general, maybe he does, maybe down deep there's something there, but he has to keep it dead inside. He can't let it get in the way of his duty. And we see as they move out of the tent that a battle has just ensued. Lots of people have died, and we're going to get a very creepy scene just a few minutes later where let's not get to that yet. So we go outside the tent. There's a lot of wounded people around, and they're being put into carts, and the carts are being hauled by the soldiers who just fought the battle. And the reporter that's with Karloff, a guy who's covering the war, like an embed, he asks him, why are you using your own soldiers? He's like, by God, they need rest. They just fought a battle all day long. And now they're carting away all these bodies. Don't you have horses to put on these carts? Don't you have like other people than the soldiers to do this work? And he says, the plague is afoot and everybody must immediately be buried. And the soldiers are aligned with him. They know the threat. That plague can be worse for an army than a lost battle. Death is everywhere in this landscape. And what's interesting is the reporter is shot taller than Karloff. So we have Karloff looming over the soldiers like he's Victor Wembanyama, and then the very first person we see that's not under his command is actually weirdly taller than him. It's like he dominates in that one space, and maybe he doesn't dominate so much in other spaces. It's kind of like Jack Nicholson's character in A Few Good Men. So now we get to the scene I was talking about, where they decide night has fallen post-battle, and the general, the reporter has offended the general by mentioning marriage, and the general has said, the reporter hinted at the general needing to have compassion for people like the way he would his wife, and the general informs him that he had a wife who had died. And then we get to the really good stuff, because it turns out his wife's body lies nearby on an island that's basically a cemetery. There isn't even supposed to be anyone living there anymore. It's just a place for the dead. A private island cemetery is the perfect setting for a comfort horror movie for me. So they decide to go visit the body. The reporter says, I'm sorry I offended you. I want to put flowers on your wife's grave to apologize. And I'm a reporter. I would love to see everything about this area because I'm covering this. And the general says it's been a long, long time since he's been to his wife's grave. Let's go do it. So they take a boat, which looks like a gondola from Venice, and this spooky passage from where the battle is fought across the water to the island in the dead of night. And this reporter brings a lantern. And when you're wandering around black and white horror movies with lanterns, you're in my cover horror spot there too. So he leaves the lantern on the far shore where they depart from. They go in the boat and they land on the island. And when the reporter looks back as they're about to walk into the center of the island of the dead, he looks back and the lantern mysteriously goes out and darkness just falls. Now, for a movie that only runs 72 minutes, there's quite a bit of plot and quite a few characters. So I'm not going to go into the depths of this movie, especially because you can enjoy it for yourself. I will do spoilers because I have to talk about how beautiful the ending is. So I'll give a little warning before I get there. But fuck it. I mean, it's not like this is spoilers, whatever. This is a masterpiece. It's like spoiling the Mona Lisa. Like, you know what the Mona Lisa looks like, but when you go stand in front of it at the Louvre, unless you're, you know, surrounded by a million tourists, like, it's an amazing experience, even though you know what it looks like. So they get to the Isle of the Dead. They discover that the general's wife's body is missing from its crypt, that the coffin has been broken open, and that most of the coffins have been broken open and the bodies are missing. And then they hear this eerie singing. Oh, God, a great moment. On a misty cemetery island with like this spooky singing going on, leading you on and on, trying to figure out who's doing it. And they come to a house where there's a group of people who are holed up, basically sequestering themselves against the plague. There's an archaeologist, a housekeeper, diplomats, some other characters, and the general and his companion discover that in the 15 years since the general has visited this isle, that the people who live there decided, so there's two competing theories about what's causing these plagues. One is the scientific medical theory, and there is a doctor in this house who has a very plain explanation for it. He says it's a plague being carried by fleas. He's like, the fleas, he says something really weird, like the fleas have like an 80% moisture content of their bodies. Their bodies are like 80%. I mean, I don't know, given our moisture content, I guess that's not so weird. But he says when the hot, dry wind, I forget what they call it there, but it's like their Santa Ana wind, when that wind blows, it kills all the fleas and the plague no longer spreads. So they're just hiding out in the house waiting for this hot southerly, let's call it, wind to blow and kill all the plague fleas. That's the scientific theory about what's causing the plague. The other theory is that it's the Vorvalica. Now, let's pause on this for a second. Remember that I said that this was like other classic movies, but a couple clicks over. And that's because the Greek vampire, the traditional Greek vampire presented in this movie, isn't like anything else I've seen. Now, that could just be ignorance on my part, right? There could be like 50 good Greek vampire movies. And I apologize. Like, I should research that after I do this episode. But I haven't seen them. So I haven't seen this in movies presented this way. But the Vervalica, when you research it, is this crazy mixture of like vampire with a werewolf, but the vampire doesn't drink blood. It eats livers. Like, it loves to eat human livers. The way you become a Vervalica is if you die after living a sacrilegious life, or if you were excommunicated, if you're buried in unconsecrated ground, if you get wounded by a wolf or a werewolf, or you're a werewolf and then you get killed, and then after you get killed, you become a Vervalica. But so it's this weird amalgam of just a lot of horror traditions. But my personal favorite part of this is that the Vervalica becomes stronger and stronger over time. So the traditional Greek culture believed, at least from the research I did, that you couldn't, it was almost your duty, your patriotic duty, to hunt these things down and destroy them. It wasn't like, you know, Dracula, you know, he can live, you know, Bela Lugosi's Dracula could have lived 500 years, 1,000 years or whatever, and he would still just be Bela Lugosi's Dracula. Sure, he might be wiser. Sure, he might have learned more after living all that time, but he's not necessarily more powerful in any other way. But the Vervalica just gets more and more powerful until it can unleash devastating plagues that wipe out entire cities. So you're on the clock with these creatures. You have to destroy them. There's an urgency to it. And the housekeeper in this place, she believes it's the Vervalica causing all of these plague deaths. So the general is stunned to discover that the plague is loose in this house, and he immediately orders them all quarantined, including himself. He literally cuts himself off from his own troops. And when the reporter says, "How can you not go back to your troops? I'm sure you're going to make us all stay here in this house until you're sure we're not infected. But it's odd that you're not going to go back to your troops." And he's like, an army with no general is better than an army with a general that carries the plague. The plague is scaring the shit out of everyone here. So the general believes the scientist, and he orders all of the people in the house to follow the scientist's instructions. And this is where this movie gets a little bit like John Carpenter's The Thing, because some of them believe it's the plague and they're trying to figure out which one of them is infected, if anyone. Some of them believe it's a supernatural Vervalica force, and that means which one of them is the Vervalica and who has she gotten to. And they're all trapped together in this confined space with this rising sense of paranoia. But the general has put all his chips on the scientist and the scientific solution. He's like, "We're going to wash our hands frequently." There we go again. We're washing our hands all the time like we're guilty. "We're going to not gather in groups. We're going to social distance inside this house. And we're going to ride this thing out until the hot southerly wind blows." And that's something else I just absolutely adore about this movie, is they keep teasing you by showing you things like people's big flowing dresses or the flags that are high on the flagpoles that are just limp and dead up there. And you're just waiting, and then they stir a little and you're like, "Oh, here it comes. Here comes the wind that sets them free," and then nothing happens. So there's this like stillness about this aisle where the sounds really carry. You can hear the birds and the crickets at night because there's no competing breeze. Everything is just really still. And visually your eyes keep looking for some kind of clue that the wind is going to come and save them. But guess who dies of the plague next? The scientist, of course. So now Karloff is doubting himself, and the housekeeper is pouring poison into his ear about the Vervalica. She's like, "Aren't you a true Greek? Don't you believe this? Don't you know this is how this works?" The Vrvolika is going to make us sick one after the other after the other while she grows healthier looking and more energetic. Her eyes are going to glow with life. Her cheeks are going to be red with blood, or, I don't know, brown with livers. Ew. And meanwhile, they're being opposed by this glorious character named Thea. I think they call her Taya. I'm just going to say Thea because that's what it looks like to me. But no, I'm going to say Taya. Fuck it. It sounds better. Sounds cooler. So Taya is like, she's against all this superstitious nonsense. She's sure that it's just the plague. She's really fulfilling the scientist role, but without any scientific knowledge, just like practical common sense. She also absolutely hates the general. And this is where it gets interesting that he's nicknamed the Watchdog, because he's watching over them. He's watching over the army. He is acting like the plague is just another enemy that he's meeting on the field and can conquer with the right set of moves. But Taya has heard rumors about this guy and how he behaved when he last came to this island and how strict and tyrannical he is. And she thinks that he's a dictator. So she's for the common sense stuff, but she's against the no exceptions, no bending the rules. Like if someone here has a medical emergency, the general would just leave them here to die because he wouldn't let them off the island to possibly spread the plague. But Taya would be like, I'm doing this all on a case-by-case basis. She's kind of a stand-in for us, like a sensible, in-the-middle-of-things viewer. Of course, at this point, the reporter has fallen in love with her because she's absolutely beautiful. And because she hates the general, he starts to really turn on the general and become not an objective journalist, but someone who thinks the general is taking things too far. And there's another character which is going to lead to this movie's absolute best moment. One of the best moments and best visuals of any horror movie from the 30s, 40s, or 50s. Her name is Mary St. Aubin, and she's afraid. She has a medical condition that runs in her family where she can fall into a death-like trance but not actually be dead. And she's Serpent in the Rainbow style, terrified of premature burial. And she has gotten a promise from the scientist that if she looks like she's dead, he won't bury her like everybody else, even though burying the bodies and getting them out of there is the only way to stop the plague, that he'll find some way around that at least to buy her some time, because she might really not be dead. Of course, he's now dead, the scientist, so that promise is null and void because nobody else knows about it. And of course, poor doomed Mrs. Aubin is going to fall into one of these states, weakened from the plague, I believe, and then be buried, although not, she's not dead. And we know it because we heard her say it, but when they hold a feather up to her nostrils and it doesn't stir, and they put a mirror up to her mouth and there's no fog on the glass, the camera goes really close in and we see her. And she's not moving, and she looks dead, but we know that she's not. And they put her in a coffin, but it's not a coffin. It's just a box that they stored antiquities in. It looks like something from Indiana Jones. I think it actually says antiquities on it. So she's stored away like a dark little lost treasure, and she's put into the crypt. And the camera takes us there a couple times through a couple scenes where we know she's in there, and we know she's going to wake up in the absolute pure blackness, and we know that her nightmare is going to be realized and that her brain's going to snap and she's going to lose it. And as the camera focuses in on this creepy fucking box in this absolutely gorgeously black and white rendered crypt, on this like godforsaken island, it's just ravishingly, darkly beautiful. And of course, she's startled awake in the box, even though the camera never takes us in there. It never makes the mistake of taking us in. we don't get the scene of her like flicking a lighter or striking a match and seeing her face. No, it's all from the outside. You got to use your imagination here. And we hear this blood-curdling scream that again carries across the windless island, making goosebumps come up on everyone's skin who hears it. And then we hear her fingernails on the inside of it. And we know how bad that is. We hear her scratching and banging, trying to get out of there. And we know from her laugh that she's going absolutely purely insane. And then the camera goes away to other people hearing the scream and trying to figure out what's going on. But when the camera comes back later, because she's going to be in there for a while, when the camera comes back later, this is the moment. Because what's happening here is some water is pooled above the coffin, the crate, and it's starting to drip down the beam, and it's landing on the coffin, just pat, pat, pat. Just imagine being trapped inside a coffin and having this water drip sound just like echoing in the space like little hammers, just trapped in there, and this sound reminding you of the outside world. You know exactly what it looks like, this like water relentlessly dripping down intermittently. Oh my God, it's so good. She breaks out of the coffin and she looks insane, and she wanders around this creepy island in these white flowing robes that looks a lot like I walked with a zombie. Just absolutely gorgeous stuff. She's in full lady in white mode, like Lucy from Dracula. And she's, with her broken brain, she's out for revenge. So good. Meanwhile, the general, who has been this strong, decisive leader this whole time, is breaking down more and more into conspiratorial things with the housekeeper, believing that Thea is the Vorvalika, because she's the only healthy, vivacious female left in their bunch, that she is the one who's like stealing everyone else's life to make herself stronger, and that she's going to unleash the plague on all of them and probably on his troops, and not only destroy him, but destroy his country. And Karloff plays this so beautifully, because he starts to stoop, he gets less tall, he looks more haunted and broken, he's got circles under his eyes. He's become less that strong leader and more just like any other paranoid, bundle of nerves in a horror movie. And he's determined to kill Thea to put a stop to the Vorvalika. The only way you can stop them, by the way, is decapitation. So she's in for a bad moment if he gets his hands on her. The reporter is trying to protect her because he loves her. They try to escape the island, but the general sabotages the escape boat. Our heroes rush out into the haunted night trying to figure out if Mrs. Aubin's there, because they've discovered that she's broken out of her coffin and they realize that they buried her alive. They don't know yet that she's become a crazy murderer. They're running around in the night. These poor people, they got to run around in the night with the world's biggest lantern I've ever seen. Like, what a handicap to have to try to like fight off the Vorvalika or a crazed killer while you're holding a lamp half the size of your body. Even the sizes of things in this movie are off in a weird way. The lanterns are too big. There's an amazingly hilarious scene earlier when the general and the reporter first get there. And the reporter's like, oh man, I've been embedded with your army so long, I haven't had a good bath in a while. So he's like, I'm going to take a bath. And the general's like, cool. And then the last thing I expected was what happened. We cut to the next scene where they're in the bedroom where they're going to be staying, both of them, the general and the reporter. And the bathtub is in the bedroom. I mean, just sitting there in front of the bed. And it's comically tidy. And the reporter's in there like, ah, this is great. This is the best bath ever. And it looks like he's been stuffed into a big coffee mug. Just amazing, amazing stuff. But Karloff's haunted presence, where he breaks down, and I won't spoil the ending, I've decided, but he is clearly not going to have the hero's death that he thought he deserved. But again, he's only part hero. He's part villain here. He really is ruthless. He really is susceptible to paranoia and snap judgments. His decisiveness in battle leads to decisively poor decisions in other areas of life. And we all know the people who think because they're really expert in one field, think they're smart in everything. We've got an absolutely great heroine in Taya, which is a great performance. The characters are cool. The plot's richer than you'd expect in a movie this short. And it's just one of the most goddamn beautiful horror movies ever made. So this is pure comfort horror for me. But again, the angle on it here that I discovered by doing this topic, which is one of the privileges of having this community and podcast, is I find out things I didn't know before. And I think it's because it stands similar but alone in the black and white classic horror genre, with familiar people like with Karloff, but doing things they didn't do in other movies, with familiar creatures like vampires, but not acting like the vampires in other films, with beautiful black and white shadows, but like not shadows in castles or decrepit mansions, but shadows in creepy islands and off, you know, tent awnings, with fanatical characters trying to scapegoat one person to blame them for the troubles of others, like Mrs. Carmody, the immortal Marcia Gay Harden in The Mist. But in this case, not doing it with bad intentions or not. I mean, you could argue she wasn't. I mean, she's a horrible person, so whatever. But in this case, it's not quite. It's like it, but not quite like it. So it's the freshness to what could have been something so familiar that makes this, aside from just being great and right up my alley, but like ever fresh, ever green as a watch, makes it a perfect comfort horror movie for me. Now let's get to the community's answers and the voting. What you all said, an update here. So I record this podcast in segments, and I said at the beginning that the winner wasn't going to be that big of a surprise, but the runner-ups were. Well, we've had a change because the votes have changed since I recorded this first segment. And now the winner is a surprise to me. Not the biggest surprise in the world, but the runner-up that was in the lead for much of this time was John Carpenter's Halloween. And that's the one that wouldn't have been a surprise to me as a comfort horror choice. So that came in second place. But the movie that emerged into the lead, that came from behind, so to speak, to take the first place with the most votes, is Sleepy Hollow. So this is Horror Weekly's most popular comfort horror movie to me. And I think it fits with a lot of what we've talked about previously. It's drenched with atmosphere. It's familiar, but not quite familiar. Johnny Depp is doing things like Johnny Depp does, but not quite like Johnny Depp does them. Christina Ricci is wearing white instead of black. But there's another element that I've neglected to all of this, which is the campfire element of it, which is why John Carpenter's The Fog is another comfort horror movie to me. But just sitting around a fire, hearing someone spin out a tale of something, which is the vibe that I get from Sleepy Hollow, and the fact that it's seasonal, right? And this is the next thing I want to talk about in the voting before I get through the actual winners, is a lot of you gave interesting, you didn't just name the movies, but because you're you and because you're fucking smart, you gave reasons for why they were your comfort horror. Even though I didn't ask for the explanations, you know that's what I want. It's not just the tally to me, even though that's what I build the podcast episode on. It's the conversations that matter. So a lot of you said, here's what my answer is, but it's because it's seasonal. Like a lot of people even gave two or three movie answers depending on the season. So like Bob Collins said, I'm very seasonal, so it varies. This time of year, it's prom night or Mother's Day or final exam. Another reason that was often given is that it was one of the first horror movies someone watched. Like Anna Orlova said, Silver Bullet, one of the first horror movies I ever saw as a kid, and I found it terrifying. Now it's just like coming home. I love that. And if it's not something you first saw, maybe it's something that just makes you feel really nostalgic. Like Grant Cameron said, when I think of comfort, I think of nostalgia. For me, that is the Monster Squad. I grew up watching a version recorded on VHS with the first 20 minutes missing. It wasn't until I was an adult when I bought it on DVD that I figured out who the guy was that took Dracula away at the end. Sometimes it's the craft of how a movie was made. Like Eugene Rossi said, for me, there is really nothing quite like Evil Dead. With the old school graphics and that low to the ground moving camera effect, the fact that they pulled it off on a low budget, I'm actually reading about it now in Bruce Campbell's autobiography. And The Evil Dead, by the way, was in the top 10 of the answers for Come From. It was in the top 10 of the voting. I just got to shout out Carol Smoes, who gave two answers, and this combination blew my mind. She said, Nosferatu, the silent movie, and my backup for comfort horror is Bride of Chucky. A subscriber in our VIP group and a supporter of the page, so thank you so much. Tracy V said, Terrifier and Terrifier 2, they are perfectly paced, hilarious, and bizarre. Because there are no dull moments and so many eclectic moments throughout, they are the perfect escape for what ails me. And I totally agree about the first Terrifier. The diner scene of the first Terrifier, for some reason, is such a comforting... I know it's supposed to be unsettling and sinister and all that, but I think it's what I was saying about Final Destination 3. It's that macabre mix of fun, morbid, and scary. Some of you were so eloquent in your answers to this question. Dave Whitehead said, while The Lost Boys is my favorite of all time, for comfort I like a revenge element, a horror Rambo like Don't Breathe, with a defeatist twist like Wolf Creek, so Ready or Not, The Hunt, Deliverance, that sort of thing. That said, Gremlins 1 and 2 on a wintry night, hard to beat. Holy shit, what a great vote. Even though it didn't get that many votes, I'm honor bound to mention this movie anytime it comes up in one of our voting, which is Ravenous, which got a handful of votes, but my God, I might just go rewatch it after recording this. Some of you gave not just answers for yourself, but your significant others, which I don't recall happening very much in our other voting. There's something about the comfort horror topic that made you guys feel inclusive about it, which I think is awesome. For example, Zach Gorillo said, my wife's comfort horror is Midsommar and mine is The Mummy. In the surprises category, I was surprised by how many votes Event Horizon got. I was also surprised by how many votes Underwater got. It got quite a few. It's not in the top 10, but it was represented much more highly than I would have expected. And then the other movies in our top five were 28 Days Later, which congratulations, sickos. And then also Tremors. So there you have it. The best comfort horror movies. I shouldn't say best. Our favorite comfort horror movies, because comfort horror, this is such a subjective topic. I mean, it's so personal, each to each. Our favorite comfort horror movies as a community, we got Sleepy Hollow and Tremors and John Carpenter's Halloween and a bunch of like one-offs like Terrifier and Event Horizon. And then we've got my personal ones and my true love. My truest love was Cat People, but I didn't want to talk about that yet again on this podcast. So I did a little sidestep and talked about another Val Lewton masterpiece. In Isle of the Dead, featuring the weird Greek vampire Vorvalika. If I ever start a metal band, Vorvalika will definitely be the name. So before I go, I'm really excited about this. When this podcast gets shouted out, I feel like they're shouting out all of us, right? This is a community effort. It's truly built on the back of the subscriber VIP group, first, because they're directly supporting this effort and helping make me able to do this every week. But all of you, really everyone who's participating, is absolutely crucial for this. I wouldn't do this podcast if the community disappeared. There'd be no point. It's built on all of our opinions. So when the podcast gets shouted out, I feel like 500,000 horror fans under the Horror Weekly banner are getting shouted out, which is great. There's a YouTuber named called Nonstop Horror, and I'll put a link in the show notes to their channel because I love how the channel is presented. It's really crisp. The ideas are obviously really felt, and he gives really, really smart, tasteful reasons for why he's choosing to cover the things that he's choosing. that's going to sound a little self-serving when I get to what he did here, but I'm talking about the stuff he does about movies. But he did a video recently called The Best Horror Podcasts, and we were shouted out first. We're literally the first podcast to be mentioned in the video, which I thought was really cool, and I really appreciated. And it used the word sensei, which I thought was hilarious and great. So thank you to Nonstop Horror for mentioning us, and go check out his channel. It's really cool. This is not a prearranged thing. I don't think he has any idea that I even saw the video or anything. I just happened to notice that he had mentioned us on Threads of all places, which is a place I'm trying to be more active. Because the subscribers, with your financial support, and again, if you're interested in helping, I set it the lowest possible price Facebook would let me. It's $2.99 a month. That's all. You join the Facebook group. You can lurk. You can participate. The conversations in there are great. I'm getting ideas for new podcast episodes, was mentioned recently about PG horror, although I need to PG-13 horror, although I need to research that, because I need to see my way into that topic. Like, I need a better angle than, yeah, there's actually good PG-13 horror movies, because I feel like we all kind of know that. I'm looking for how to twist the subject to spice it, right? But like, the conversations in there are fucking brilliant. They're way smarter than me. So you get to join the group. You either get to participate in a great community, or you can just lurk. We don't care. It's fine. Support us so that we can keep this thing going and keep this thing growing. And as soon as you leave, the charges end. So it's like the easiest thing in the world to do to cancel. All you gotta do is depart the group. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes if you're interested. All of us here working hard to make Horror Weekly go would appreciate your help. That's it for us. Episode's over. I'm hungry, so I'm going to go eat and watch Ravenous. Probably bad idea, but what the hell, let's do it. Until next Thursday, have a great Horror Week.